This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, September 24, 2002, from Pacifica Station WBAI in New York, and Deepa Fernandez. Britain unveils a dossier of reasons to go to war with Iraq. Denver secret police intelligence files show it conducts surveillance of peaceful protesters. And North and South Korea relations begin to warm. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Civil libertarians are concerned over new Justice Department guidelines that break the barrier between law enforcement and intelligence agencies. Josh Chaffin has more from D.C.
The new guidelines put on paper what the Justice Department has been doing since the passage of the USA Patriot Act just after September 11th. They're requiring federal criminal investigators to hand over evidence of what they think may be terrorist activity to the CIA and the FBI. But some of that information reaches investigators by way of a grand jury hearing, where a defendant has no lawyer. Georgetown law professor Jonathan Turley says the feds may now start using grand juries more often.
The grand jury is a wonderful traditional tool of citizens determining the basis for indictment. But a grand jury can also be the tool for abuse. The other reason there's a concern is that John Ashcroft has used virtually every element of the USA Patriot Act in its most extreme possible form.
The new guidelines severed the divide between federal investigators and intelligence agencies. The two communities had been barred from sharing grand jury information since the 1970s, when the FBI and CIA were caught monitoring political activity protected by the First Amendment. Josh Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Washington, D.C.
Hoping to move the Innocence Project Act, 135 petitions asking for criminal justice reform were given to two key congressional leaders, Senator Patrick Leahy and the original bill sponsor, William Delahert. From Capitol Hill, Gareth Schweitzer reports.
We're talking about determining real guilt and real innocence.
Senator Leahy reintroduced the Innocence Protection Act today, which is designed to guarantee DNA testing and competent counsel for anyone accused of a capital offense. The act passed the Senate Judiciary Committee in July and is co-sponsored by more than half the members of the House of Representatives. De La Hunt said today he remains optimistic that there will be swift action in the House.
I'm hoping before we do leave that we will have a bill that will end up on the president's desk.
The legislative agenda is crowded with appropriations bills, homeland security, and debate over Iraq, making passage seem unlikely before Congress recesses. The House Judiciary Committee has yet to vote on the legislation. Senator Leahy said today that because the current legislation is not a vote on the death penalty itself, he is optimistic that the president would sign the act should it reach his desk. On Capitol Hill, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gareth Schweitzer.
The United Nations Security Council adopted a resolution early this morning demanding that Israel end its siege of Ramallah and withdraw from other Palestinian cities. It also called on the Palestinian Authority to crack down on terrorism. After threatening a veto, the U.S. abstained on the measure, allowing it to pass. Susan Wood has more from the U.N.
At 2:30 this morning, after 11 hours of debate, the U.N. Security Council adopted a compromise text sponsored by its European members. Deputy Ambassador James Cunningham expressed his disappointment.
The resolution that we've adopted this evening was flawed in our view in that it failed to explicitly condemn the terrorist groups and those who provide them with political cover, support, and safe haven in perpetuating conflict in the Middle East.
The U.S. backs Israel's contention that as president of the Palestinian Authority, Yasser Arafat is responsible for the actions of extremist groups, although Arafat has jailed some of their leaders and condemned attacks against Israelis. Arab countries, meanwhile, said Israel's occupation of Palestinian territories was in violation of numerous UN resolutions and denounced what they termed double standards applied to Israel and Iraq. James Paul, executive director of Global Policy Forum, a UN watchdog organization, says Israel's actions are causing embarrassment for the U.S.
The reason the U.S. didn't veto at this point is that they are very concerned that this issue mess up their campaign at the UN and with the UN Security Council to get a resolution that will more or less authorize their war and invasion of Iraq.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
Finally, there are 1.3 million more poor people in the United States, according to newly released U.S. Census figures, making the total 32.9 million people living in poverty. Citing decreased wages and the recession, the poverty rate rose throughout various groups, including families and non-Hispanic whites. I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
A storm of controversy surrounds a newly released dossier of evidence about Iraq's development of weapons of mass destruction. British Prime Minister Tony Blair presented the document today, saying it proves Iraq has plans to use chemical and biological weapons. The dossier, Blair's most direct call for war on Iraq, states that Saddam Hussein's chemical and biological weapons are ready to be used within 45 minutes of an order to fight.
Our case is simply this. Not that we take military action, come what may, but that the case for ensuring Iraqi disarmament, as the UN itself has stipulated, is overwhelming.
Addressing the British Parliament, Blair added that Saddam Hussein has tried to acquire, quote, significant quantities of uranium from Africa, which he says proves the Iraqi president is expanding his weapons arsenal.
We have well-founded intelligence to tell us that Saddam sees his WMD program as vital to his survival, as a demonstration of his power and his influence in the region.
And as Ari Fleischer said today that U.S.-German relations are still strained, there was no official White House congratulations for re-elected German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder. And Donald Rumsfeld refused to meet with his German counterpart in an informal NATO defense ministers gathering in Warsaw. Yet President Bush wasted no time in commending Tony Blair, his most prominent supporter of the war in Iraq, for his dossier.
Prime Minister Blair, first of all, is a very strong leader, and I admire his willingness to tell the truth and to lead. Secondly, he continues to make the case, like we make the case, that Saddam Hussein is a threat to peace, that for 11 years he has deceived the world.
However, Iraq flatly rejected Blair's assertions, calling his dossier a, quote, campaign of lies led by Zionists against Iraq. Iraqi Culture Minister Hamad Yusuf Hamdi told the Associated Press that the British Prime Minister won't get his ideas past his own legislature.
Mr. Blair is acting as part of the Zionist campaign against Iraq. So all his claims are baseless. And his claims will be challenged by his own Labour Party in the House of Commons.
Charles Kennedy, leader of the Liberal Democrats, urged Britain and the United States to work through the United Nations, saying he is wary about a war for the sake of regime change.
For those of us who have never subscribed to British unilateralism, we are not about to sign up to American unilateralism now either.
Investigative journalist for London's Guardian newspaper and the BBC, Greg Pallast, says Tony Blair's dossier is more about internal Labour Party politics. On the one hand, he says, Blair is trying to flush out the left-leaning members of his party. And on the flip side, Pallast sees the dissent within the Labour Party as stemming more from a desire to not be seen as blindly following George W. Bush than it is about not wanting war on Iraq.
His own party members are dead set against the war, overwhelmingly against going to war with Iraq. And there's two reasons. One is that the British Empire is used to dealing with dictators for a long time. After all, Margaret Thatcher's son was selling arms to Iraq. So they don't have a problem with killer maniacs in the Mideast. The other is that they don't want to see Britain be the lapdog of the Bush presidency.
This is a poll in Tuesday's Guardian newspaper said 86% of Britons believe the government should seek the support of the British Parliament and the United Nations before taking military action against Iraq. 15 European heads of state, along with 10 of their East and Southeast Asian counterparts, are meeting in Copenhagen, Denmark, for the Asia-Europe Summit. The summit, known this year as SM4, has met every 2 years since 1994. Organisers say this year's summit will see European-Asian relations make its presence known on the global scene. But hundreds of representatives from Asian and international civil society groups came to Copenhagen this weekend to hold their own summit on themes of globalization, people-centered security, and social and economic and political and cultural rights. Patrick Beckett reports from ASEM 4 People's Forum.
The 600 women and men representing over 30 countries in Asia and Europe are demanding an immediate change in Europe-Asia relations to place a priority on people's rights, sustainable economic and social development, and people-centered security. The forum was centered on Asia-Europe relations. Many delegates had a common complaint. Professor Johan Goltung is a Norwegian peace researcher.
The world is today suffering from a major problem. It suffers from many problems, but it has one key problem. The problem has a name, and the name of that problem is United States of America.
Many at the conference asserted the U.S. is pursuing unilateral aims for its own benefit. Last week, George Bush presented a U.S. security policy explicitly stating U.S. intention for preemptive unilateral military action. Bush himself called on the United Nations to follow the U.S. lead. Again, Professor Galtung.
Pull the United Nations out of the United States as soon as possible. It's a bad environment. If UN gets out of the U.S., the obvious second formula is U.S. out of the UN. Leave it. If you don't respect international law, if you leave all the protocols you want to leave, if you go alone because you feel that you are chosen to God by God and the world is organized by God on top, then US, and so close that there is space for nothing in between, like the UN Charter, leave it. Come back when you join the world.
Many delegates at the forum are looking towards the upcoming WTO ministerial meeting in Cancun next September as an important focus for changing the harmful effects of these policies. Gigi Francisco with the Philippine Women's Group, Development Alternatives for a New Era, describes some of the problems imposed by the neoliberal economic model.
The rights of people over their land and natural resources, food security, health, education, housing, in other words, the right of ordinary women and men and their families and communities to a life with dignity, have been sacrificed in the altar of private property, free competition, and rapid growth.
On Saturday, demonstrators marched from the forum venue through the center of Copenhagen and past the multinational firms of Maersk Shipping and ISS, which provides cleaning, catering, and maintenance services worldwide.
Our world is not for sale, people, not profit.
Speakers described the unfair labor standards of these institutions, including low pay, lack of health care, and no retirement benefits. Danish Member of Parliament Pernille Rosenkrantz-Theil spoke on the problem of multinationals.
We don't want large companies to be more powerful than people. We don't want to put up with the fact that the multinationals do not contribute to community. And last but not least, we don't want the multinationals to smash up the development of the third world.
Later, representatives from the forum held another demonstration outside the highly fortified meeting center. Along the road, they placed 25 copper sculptures of starving children wearing sweatshop shoes, standing on their own coffins. The message they hope to send is, hungry for social justice. As the forum came to a close, organizers presented a final statement to the Danish Foreign Ministry. Denmark currently chairs the EU. Organizers hope the demands will be considered by the 15 European Union heads of state, as well as those from China, Japan, Korea, Brunei, Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore, Thailand, Vietnam, and the Philippines, who began their meeting in Copenhagen this week. In Copenhagen, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Patrick Beckett.
South Korea's defense ministry set up a hotline with the North Korean military today to facilitate communication between the two countries as they reconnect rails and roads through their border, known as the most heavily mined area in the world. North and South Korea began constructing rails and roads on September 18, a landmark event symbolically piercing the world's last Cold War frontier, which has been in place since the 1950-1953 Korean War. Meantime, European and Asian heads of states meeting in Copenhagen, Denmark, called for the resumption of talks between the United States and North Korea, called part of the Axis of Evil by George W. Bush. FSRN's Aaron Glantz is at the summit, and he files this report.
In his remarks before the opening of the Europe-Asian Summit, South Korean President Kim Dae-jung said the opening of road and rail links points towards a future unified Korea, which he said would constitute an Iron Silk Road directly linking Europe with Korea over land. Speaking to reporters in Copenhagen today, European Union President Anders Fogh Rasmussen joined leaders from throughout Asia and Europe in expressing hope that the issues of North Korea's missile and nuclear-related matters would be resolved through dialogue, not war.
After this summit, I am encouraged and I foresee a development characterized by peace and stability on the Korean Peninsula.
In October 2000, North Korea and the U.S. released a joint communique for the first time, stating there was no more hostile intent towards the other and confirmed the commitment of both governments to make every effort in the future to build a new relationship free from past enmity. The talks were supported by then-President Bill Clinton, but when George W. Bush became president, that changed. Dr. Rainer Werning of the Reichenlist Journalist Bureau in Cologne, Germany.
It was prior to September 11, even. It was in March 2001 that South Korean delegation showed up in Washington, and it was the first Asian head of state, Kim Dae-jung, who showed up in Washington, and there he really looked like a wet poodle, because President Bush called him naive and attacking him for pursuing the Sunshine Policy.
Then, in his 2002 State of the Union address, President Bush named North Korea as part of an axis of evil, pulling the U.S. out of regional peace talks. Since then, observers say tension between the North and the South has increased, as has tension between the United States and the Korean people. Young Mo-noon is International Secretary of the Korean Congress of Trade Unions. He says U.S. military forces in South Korea have begun to operate with impunity. On June 13th, a U.S. armored vehicle ran over two middle school girls who were walking down the street just outside of Seoul. The entire incident was captured on videotape.
They were run over twice. The armored vehicle went forward once, which resulted in crushing the two girls, and this vehicle reversed and came back and ran over again those two bodies. And this has raised a lot of questions about how the U.S. military in Korea has become totally immune from any mechanisms of justice or any mechanisms of legal oversee. But this all that have given rise to greater tensions between the Korean citizens and the U.S. military, and which is becoming aggravated every day.
They haven't been charged with any crime.
No, the U.S. military authorities have said that they will investigate, but they will not, at the moment, see any need for laying charges against them, because they feel the authorities, U.S. military authorities, feel that it was done in the course of their military duty. So nothing involving their personal liability.
The United States maintains 96 military bases with more than 50,000 troops in South Korea. Young Mo-noon and other observers believe the Bush administration seeks to ensure continued enmity between North and South Korea as a justification for a large U.S. military presence close to China. But Young Mo believes a real peace between North and South is possible if the people of the world remain engaged.
Despite all these problems concerning the peace and security issues in Korea, there has been recently really important developments, like the decision to relink the railroads, railway tracks, in linking South and North Korea. And the more this process is seen by others and talked about, the more it will be the people will have control over it, rather than the governments. So I think it's very important that people know about it and people have say about it, so that the whole process is not left to the governments, like U.S. administrations or the governments in North or South Korea.
And yet the most powerful force for peace between the two Koreas could be money. Today, South Korea's state oil company announced it plans to search for oil and gas reserves in the North. Five multinational oil companies are already looking for oil in and offshore North Korea, including SOCO of Canada and the Australian firm Beach Petroleum. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz in Copenhagen.
Earlier this year, the ACLU of Colorado obtained documents from secret Denver Police Department intelligence files. These documents show the Denver Police Department conducts surveillance and keeps files on peaceful protesters. The ACLU is suing to stop this monitoring of legal, nonviolent political activity. And after a period of review, the city decided to allow citizens to find out if there's a file on them. Daniel Costello reports.
This is an incident report from May 22, 1991. It records the fact that I was engaged in protests against Israeli policy.
Mark Cohen is an activist who belongs to several peace and justice groups in Denver. He is examining his police intelligence file outside the department headquarters.
It reports on the fact that I participated in an Amnesty International rally. That sounds really criminal. It's all my participation in perfectly legal demonstrations in which I exercise my rights as a citizen of a supposedly democratic society. It doesn't look like there's anything in here that could possibly have any legitimate law enforcement purpose.
There are files on 208 groups and 3,277 individuals. They range from people with weapons convictions to groups engaged in protest activities. Activists say the information collected on them does not meet the definition for reasonable suspicion of criminal activity. The Quaker organization American Friends Service Committee has a file and was identified as a criminal extremist group. Antonia Anthony is a Franciscan sister and one of the plaintiffs on the ACLU lawsuit. She is a member of the Chiapas Coalition, which was also identified as a criminal extremist group.
It is kind of strange for a 74-year-old nun to be called as kind of a terrorist. We are exercising our constitutional rights. And as a matter of fact, if we're going to preserve our democracy, we've got to be able to do these kind of things. And to not be able to do it is to act like we're not a free people. I think it's very important that we are able to speak out against things that we know to be wrong.
The police department has acknowledged that there are problems with the type and quality of information in the files. Lieutenant Steve Carter is an assistant to Police Chief Jerry Whitman. He has been handling relations with the public about the intelligence files.
We've gone through a lengthy review process since this issue broke last March. We've been looking very strongly at our policy on what kinds of information we'll retain, how long we'll retain it, what methods we'll use to collect it, and whatnot. And one of the decisions we came to is there's a number of files that we were willing to purge from our database that were something that we felt that we no longer had a need to have, or we just didn't need to be in possession in the first place.
The police department has written a strict new policy on intelligence collection. Mark Silverstein, legal director for the ACLU of Colorado, is not satisfied. He says that there already was a policy in the Denver Police Department that prohibited the gathering of information on a person's beliefs, opinions, and expressive activities.
If a written policy back last year was not enough to stop the police from doing this, why should we believe that a rewritten policy is going to be enough to stop this practice? There has to be some kind of monitoring, some kind of auditing by an independent body or an independent official who has the confidence and trust of the public.
Many activists doubt the police explanation for how and why the files were created. They believe the surveillance is an intimidation tactic meant to stifle unpopular speech. Lieutenant Carter says the police must be at protests to maintain order.
If someone's protesting, oftentimes that means there's somebody else that doesn't agree with them. It's our job to monitor public events for public safety. So we have a duty to be at these demonstrations, and we should be there, and the public expects us to be there. Now, whether or not it makes people feel uncomfortable about expressing their opinions, we can't help that.
Last week, the police department revealed that it found three more intelligence files in an old file cabinet. The revelation spurred the city to relax the rules for obtaining files, allowing people to mail in notarized requests rather than having to appear in person. Files will be available for review until November 1st. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Daniel Costello in Denver.
It's been 9 months since the people of Argentina ousted President De La Rúa and two subsequent presidential administrations as well. This past weekend, Argentinians took to the streets again with the same protest cry demanding that all politicians leave their posts. Recent confrontations with the police and massive looting have caused the death of 30 people. Sebastian Hatcher and Thomas Zamot file this report from Buenos Aires.
The demonstrators believe the elections scheduled for December is a sham. Camilo, a member of a popular assembly, explained why he joined the thousands of protesters in the Plaza de Mayo in front of the president's residence in Buenos Aires.
Como asamblea, como movimiento asambleístico, digamos, nació.
We, the Movement of Assemblies, were born on the 20th of December. We want to remind you that we want to stay on the streets. We will continue until all the powerful leave. None of them will remain. We are against the lie of the elections in which the politicians want us to participate. We think that they all must leave because nobody believes them. We all know that they stand for the interest of only part of society, the part that manages the economy. We believe that it is still important to keep in mind the 20th of December because on this day, it was the people in the streets that threw down De La Rúa.
Even though the Argentinian Congress declared former Senator Dualde president last January, since then the same government is still in power. Because Congress appointed Senator Dualde as president of Argentina, many Argentinians have organized a number of demonstrations protesting the legitimacy of his presidency. The past weekend's demonstration also singled out the IMF's plans to decrease money for education and healthcare. Argentinians complain each day more citizens are sinking into poverty, while unemployment is considered a matter of fact, impossible to change. Norma, of a piqueteros movement called Barrios de Pie, or Rise Up Neighborhoods, tell us the $40 monthly government subsidy paid to the head of the household is not enough to calm down the social situation, prompting Argentinians to demonstrate.
We must go to the streets. What I want is to leave something better to my children. Maybe the older people cannot be saved, but at least we must help the children. I'm a lonely single mother and I have 5 children. I think that these elections are all about selling the few things we still have here in Argentina. The people that are really conscious that these motherfuckers stole everything won't vote for anybody.
Now, the government has finally called for elections scheduled for next March, but many of Argentinian citizens are skeptical that the situation will improve with a new president. Many in the popular assemblies and the unemployed workers' movement say they have little faith in the elections because they are called only to vote a new president, not a new government. Maria, from another piqueteros movement called Territorial Liberation Movement, sings.
Evidentemente la situación aquí en la Argentina ya no da para más. Es una nueva reafirmación de que estamos en contra, digamos, de este gobierno.
We can't stand the situation anymore here in Argentina. This demonstration shows one more time that we're against this government, that nobody was expecting for it. And the only thing they're doing is perpetuating the politics of the system with the imperialism that only means starvation and misery for our people. We think that all politicians must leave. We believe that this is the only alternative to liberate us from the situation of oppression in which we're living. We're against these elections that are obviously going to be a lie. That's why we're having this big demonstration. We want to tell the government and the system to stop their dirty business and stop cheating the people.
For Free Speech Radio News, we are Sebastián Acher and Tomás Amod from Buenos Aires, Argentina.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York and KPFA in Berkeley and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Katza Mester with production assistance from Scott Gurian. Headlines editor is Randy Zimmerman and Jade Paget-Seekins is our technical producer. We have technical assistance from Pauline Bartolone, web support from Vanessa Tate, and our interns are Rosalind Fay, Susan Chelli, Fernando Romero, Christopher Martinez and William Perdomo. I'm Deepa Fernandez.